Good afternoon, and thank you for standing by for today's conference call. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect your lines at this time. Now I'll turn the meeting over to Ms. Trina Ray. Ma'am, you may begin.
Thank you very much, and welcome, everyone, to the Charm Telecon for March of 2008. We have a very exciting topic today. Dr. Chris McKay is a planetary scientist up at NASA Ames and is an expert in astrobiology. And there's a lot of interesting astrobiology out in the Saturn system, both with Enceladus and Titan. And so we're very pleased to have him with us today and looking forward to a really terrific talk. Everyone is welcome to ask questions if they like during the presentation, or questions at the end is just fine. And with that, I'll turn it over to Dr. McKay.
Great. Thanks. And hello to everybody. Happy to be talking to you about Titan and Enceladus, which are clearly the two stars of the Saturn system with respect to astrobiology, and in fact, in the whole solar system. I want to start, let's look at slide one, and the title is Organics on Titan, Water on Enceladus, and that summarizes why these worlds are so interesting to us from an astrobiology point of view. On Titan, we find all sorts of organic products being produced by the photochemistry in the atmosphere. And on Enceladus, there's, as you all know, jets of water, ice coming out from the South Pole. So these are the reasons why these objects are so interesting from us from an astrobiology point of view. I want to start by a little motivation with this slide two. Why is life on other worlds interesting? And it's useful to think about why we're searching for life on other worlds when we talk about what we're going to look for. But to my mind, the real interest in searching for life on other worlds, as it says here in slide two, is the possibility of finding a second genesis of life. That is, not just finding life, but finding alien life, something that's different, has a different origin than life on Earth, and presumably, therefore, would have a different chemistry. Why is that interesting? Two reasons. One is, as I say here, comparative biochemistry. We had a different type of life with a different chemistry, we would be able, for the first time, to do comparative biochemistry, which we can't do now because we only have one example of biochemistry, namely that chemistry on Earth. So if we found alien life, we'd be able to see what other ways is it possible to do the biochemistry that leads to life. And that could have deep implications for our understanding of biochemistry, which, of course, could have implications for everything from our understanding of diseases and pest control and agriculture and everything that's rooted in our understanding of biochemistry. So it could be enormously important scientifically and practically. The other implication of finding a second genesis of life is that it would provide convincing evidence that life is common in the universe. If we could show that right here in our own solar system, life started twice independently, then that would be convincing evidence that life is common in the universe. And as you see on slide two, I've added my own little editorial comment there. Yay, it would be great to know that life is indeed common in the universe. With one example, we can't really make that conclusion. But with two examples, we can. The big difference between one example of life and having two separate examples. So that's what we're looking for. Well, let's go to slide three, and of course you've seen these before, the jets of water on Enceladus. And as you know, Cassini just recently did its deepest flyby yet through these jets with interesting results, in fact, that are going to be discussed at a press conference tomorrow. So the jets coming out of Enceladus were a big surprise hit from an astrobiology point of view, and there's still debate as to what is the origin of these jets, where they're coming from, and what their cause are. But from an astrobiology point of view, the model that has the most potential is the model in which the jets are coming from a subsurface water system. So if we go to slide four, the representation of what this subsurface water system might be. Some sort of pocket of liquid water below the surface, venting through cracks in the ice. If that's the case, that subsurface pocket of liquid water is a really interesting target in terms of the possibilities of life. So that's what I want to focus on. If there is such a subsurface pocket of water, and I emphasize that that's only one of the models for explaining the geysers. If there is such a subsurface pocket, is it a likely target for life? So if we go to slide five, The question we're asking has two parts, really. Given liquid water on Enceladus, but we're going to assume that for the rest of this talk, is there a plausible origin of life on Enceladus and a plausible ecology for that life? And I separate these problems because it's important to separate them, because there may be places in the solar system where life could survive, but it hasn't originated. And there may be places where at one time life originated, but it no longer persists because there's no longer an ecology, habitability, and energy to support it. So we're going to ask both of these questions. Unfortunately, when we talk about the origin of life, we don't really know what we're talking about. We don't have a theory for the origin of life. And so slide 6 shows the best we can do, which is to diagram all the different origins for the theory of life that have been proposed for Earth and try to apply it for Enceladus. Now, when we look at Earth, we know that there's life on Earth. Look out the window and see it. We don't know how it got here. We have not yet solved the mystery of the origin of life on Earth. But there's no shortage of suggestions for how life got here. So this diagram on slide 6 shows these various suggestions organized according to categories. And the fundamental category is life started on Earth versus life didn't start on Earth. Life came to Earth in the material that formed the Earth. That's called panspermia. But most people favor the theories in which life did start on Earth, and there's various modifications of that. All of these theories are suggested for Earth, but some of them could also apply equally well to a subsurface aquifer on Enceladus, and I've marked those. Obviously, if panspermia is true, material that formed the solar system had dormant organisms in it, and these dormant organisms fell into environments and then grew if the environment was suitable, then these same spores could have been contained in Enceladus, so that's okay for the origin of life. But also, the theory, the so-called warm primordial soup theory, which in this diagram is called endogenous production of organics, in which the environment started off with a mix of organics and water, and life emerged from that mix. Well, that might have happened on Enceladus if the material that formed Enceladus was rich in organics, and if it formed out of cometary-type material, it should have been. Another theory for the origin of life is that life originated in chemical systems, such as would be occurring at the bottom of the ocean with sulfide-rich water coming out of the bottom of the ocean reacting with iron or other materials in the ambient environment. That is, in fact, right now probably the most popular theory for the origin of life on Earth, the current popular theory. That might also work in a subsurface environment on Enceladus. So the conclusion would be, with respect to the origin of life on Enceladus, is we don't know if life could have started on Enceladus, but then we don't know how life started on Earth, so our ignorance is not necessarily indicative here. But given the range of theories for the origin of life on Earth, some of those, many of those, could also apply for Enceladus, so we have reason to be optimistic that life could have got started on Enceladus. So let's turn now to the second question. If there was life on Enceladus, could it still be going today? Could this liquid water environment still be habitable? Could there be a plausible ecology? So if we turn to slide 7, I've listed some approaches to understanding whether an environment has a plausible ecology. Well, one is to base it just on laws of physics, and people love to do this, and they speculate about life forms that live off exotic energy sources like electric fields and thermal gradients. Not very satisfying. The second approach is to focus on extremophiles, certain organisms that can do seemingly extreme survival tricks, radiation resistance, salt tolerance, etc. But the third approach that I list here is the one that I favor and I think is more plausible, which is to look at actual ecosystems. To go on Earth to places where there's actually microbial ecosystems that are living under the environment that we postulate on another world. Because organisms don't obtain energy from all the possible physical sources. And individual extremophiles do not a community make. And so actual ecosystems are really the best way to approach the question of plausible ecologies on Enceladus. And to live in a subsurface aquifer on Enceladus would mean that we're talking about microbial ecosystems that could live without light, they're deep below the surface, and without oxygen. There's no reason to think that Enceladus would have built up oxygen like we find on the Earth. And as we know, of course, most of Earth's history, Earth also didn't have oxygen. So we want to find ecosystems on Earth that live without oxygen, without light. And in fact, there are, we now know, and these are recent discoveries in the last 10 years or so, three ecosystems that are really profoundly isolated. And isolated, as we look on slide 8, I give these examples, and I define what I mean by isolated. Isolated means that they survive without oxygen, they survive without light, and they survive without organic input. That's pretty amazing. No light, no oxygen, no food. They really are completely self-reliant. We have three ecosystems known. Two, as shown here, are based on methane production, where they basically are eating hydrogen that is released from rock reactions with water. So water reacts with basaltic rocks. It releases hydrogen. Hydrogen plus carbon dioxide provides an energy source for this community. And there's an example of this discovered in the deep basalts, Columbia River Basin, or in the border of Oregon and Washington. And there's another one discovered in the salts in the Idaho Falls. So we have two of these ecosystems, both based on methanogens. A new one was discovered recently, mines in South Africa, where the energy is based on chemistry produced by radioactive decay. So radiation decay produces hydrogen and peroxide, and that generates a reaction scheme shown in the next slide. We're now on slide 9. Showing in slide 9 the reaction scheme for this energy source provided by radiolysis, radioactive decay. Radiation splits the water to form hydrogen and to form oxidants. The oxidants react to form sulfate, and then sulfate-reducing bacteria use that as an energy source. So these three ecosystems, two methanogens and this one sulfate-reducing bacteria system, live completely independent of the rest of the biosphere. They don't rely on sunlight. They don't rely on oxygen made by plants or oxygen in any form. They don't rely on food, organic material produced by other organisms. These are examples of ecosystems that could survive in the aquifer of Enceladus. And they're interesting because they are an entire community of organisms. They are the primary producers are defined in the first case, two cases, methanogens, and the second case, third case rather, it's sulfur-reducing bacteria. But there's other organisms in there completing the food web. So these are complete ecosystems that cycle materials and nutrients through them. So an example of how, for the next slide, slide 10, shows an example of how this might work on Enceladus. So here is, for example, the methanogen-based ecosystem. If the methanogen-based microbes are living in the water, they are consuming hydrogen and CO2 producing methane. If that methane-rich water is recycled down deeper into the subsurface of Enceladus and it sees higher temperatures, temperatures above 500 degrees centigrade or so, that methane will cycle back to hydrogen, which could then be released in the water, completing the cycle, and the organisms could essentially be consuming this geologically produced hydrogen and CO2. That's a system that we can now point to and say we have examples on Earth of microbial ecosystems that could work with exactly this mechanism. And we would predict that one of the products of such an ecosystem would be methane. And interestingly, methane is seen in the plume in Enceladus. Now, often when we talk about Enceladus, people mention the deep sea vents on Earth. Go to slide 11. I've shown pictures of these vents and the worm tubes that are associated with them. But these are not good examples for Enceladus. They were not on my list of plausible ecosystems. And the reason is that the metabolism at these vents is based on consumption of oxygen. The chemistry that powers these vents and that powers the wondrous ecosystems associated with the vents, the clams and the worms, is the oxidation of hydrogen sulfide. Well, oxygen that these vents are consuming is produced at the surface of the earth by plants. So it is not true that these vents are isolated from the surface. It's sometimes stated, but it's incorrect. They require oxygen. Now, it may be that below the surface of this vent, away from the oxygen, there are anaerobic chemoautotrophic ecosystems that don't require oxygen. But this has yet to be determined. So the next slide, slide 12, shows a picture of the Stardust spacecraft, kind of a rough sketch. If the plume of Enceladus is really the vents from a biological reaction chamber, then the stuff that's flying out in that geyser should contain the bits and pieces of these organisms that are living in this subsurface chamber. So one possible mission design would be to fly through and collect those pieces and bring them back. And Stardust is a mission that has collected bits of a comet's tail and brought it back. It flew through the plume of a comet and brought the material back to Earth. Well, that same spacecraft, or a derivative of it, could fly through the plume of Enceladus and bring some of that material back to Earth. And we could then do a lot more detailed measurements than we could do on Cassini. Cassini is flying through the plume and is giving us a lot of good data, but it wouldn't be able to, say, search for organisms. Whereas if we brought a sample back through Stardust, through a Stardust-like spacecraft, we could. So let's imagine we do that. Let's imagine that in a future mission, we fly through Enceladus and collect material and bring it back to Earth. How would we be able to tell that that material is a second genesis of life? So in slide 13, lucky 13, I phrased that question. If we find organic material in the plume of Enceladus, or on Europa or Mars for that matter, how can we tell that it was ever alive? Now, presumably, the material that's come through the plume of Enceladus into space is dead. It's been, although it may have been alive in the subsurface aquifer, by the time it comes flying out in space and collected by a Stardust-like spacecraft, it will have been dead from exposure to the vacuum and solar ultraviolet and so on. So what we're probably going to have in our collector is dead microorganisms. Well, how do we recognize dead microorganisms? Well, if they're like us, if they have the same biochemistry and genetic material as life on Earth, well, then recognizing them is easy. We can use the techniques we've developed to study life on Earth to recognize Earth-like life anywhere. We could, for example, amplify their DNA. We have the capability through PCR and other techniques to see DNA at extremely low levels. We could, in principle, recognize one bug if that microbe had DNA in it. But so if it's like us, then it's easy. But remember what I said at the beginning, what we're searching for is alien life, so we're hoping it's not like us. We're hoping it doesn't have DNA, that it has some other mechanism for encoding genetic material. That would be the more interesting case. We'd like it to be alien. But as I say here in slide 13, if it's alien, then that's hard because we don't know how to search for alien life. We can't amplify its DNA if it doesn't have DNA. And if we don't know what it's using for a genetic material, we don't know how to amplify that. So that's the hard case, but it's also the interesting case. So how could we approach that? What would we do with this material that we collected from the plume of Enceladus? Well, I want to make a suggestion, of course, and in slide 14, is the suggestion of how we would be able to recognize some sort of alien life that's so different from us that it doesn't have the same biochemistry that we have. It doesn't have DNA and RNA, and maybe it doesn't even have protein. Well, what would we look for then? Well, slide 14 shows what I call the Lego principle. And the argument here is a rather simple-minded argument, and that is that biology, as we observe it, is largely built up from a small number of components stacked on top of each other. That's how Legos work. Legos work, you get a bunch of blocks, they're all the same, but by stacking the blocks in different ways, you can make all sorts of different things. So the complexity of constructions in Lego comes from the combinatorial possibilities of what you can do with just a small number of different blocks. Well, that's how life works. The Lego blocks of life on Earth are the 20 amino acids which go in to form the protein, the 5 nucleotide bases which go to form RNA and DNA, and the D sugars which go to form the polysaccharides. And with these blocks, the giant scaffolding molecules of life are built, the protein, the nucleic acids, and the polysaccharides. And they're built like Legos, stacked. The proteins are a good example. With those 20 amino acids stacked in different ways, a whole range of proteins are possible, which do everything necessary for life. And I have argued that this modularity principle, this Lego principle, is likely to be a common property of biology, as well as mass-produced children's toys, throughout the universe, because it's more efficient. It's more efficient for organisms to tailor their enzymes and biochemical machinery to just a few molecules and to use those molecules repeatedly. It's the same reason that a house made out of bricks, all the bricks are the same size. It's a lot easier to handle, manipulate, design a structure if the basic module is all the same. So that's what we call, or what I've been calling, the Lego principle. Life is like Lego, built with blocks. Well, the next slide, slide 15, shows what the Lego blocks of Earth life are. This is the Lego kit for life on Earth, the building blocks of Earth life. In the diagram here, you see the 20 amino acids, the purines and pyrimidines that form the nucleotide bases, the sugars, a few alcohols and the fatty acids, and that is the Lego kit of life. Earth life is built from these basic biomolecules. Well, that's good. Alien life, however, could be built from a different set. And that's an important point. Life on Earth uses this set. Alien life could use a different set, and it would still satisfy what I'm calling the Lego principle. And an example of that is building things out of Legos, but also building things out of, say, Lincoln Logs. When I was a kid, they didn't have Legos. Legos hadn't been invented yet. In fact, plastic hadn't even been invented yet. We played with wooden blocks called Lincoln Logs. Well, anything that you can build with Legos, I could have built with Lincoln Logs. You know, you can imagine a table. Let's imagine two tables. One table built out of Legos, and one table built out of Lincoln Logs. Both of them will function as tables. So ecologically, they're similar. At the microscopic level, they're also similar. Both Lego blocks and Lincoln Logs are built out of carbon atoms. Legos, the carbons occur in plastic. In Lincoln Logs, the carbon occurs in wood. So it's interesting. A table made out of Lego logs and a table made out of Lincoln Logs are the same at the highest level, they're both tables, and they're the same at the lowest level. They're both made out of carbon atoms. But they're different in the middle. They're different in the way the carbon atoms are arranged to form the building blocks from which the structures are made. We call that biochemistry. So alien life could have the same elements, and it could have the same ecology, and it could have different biochemistry. That's the clue that we might look for when we search for alien life. But it's got to have some sort of biochemistry. And an example of why life has to choose certain molecules is shown in the next slide, slide 16. This shows the amino acids, which are one of the Lego blocks of life on Earth. But life only uses the L amino acid, the left-handed amino acid, in proteins. Life doesn't use the D amino acids in proteins. Life has to choose. In proteins, these amino acids are stacked on top of each other. But they only stack if they all have the same handedness. It's like driving on the road. It doesn't really matter whether everybody drives on the left or the right, but we all have to agree to drive on one side. Well, the same with molecules. It doesn't really matter whether life uses left or L or D, but it's got to use one or the other. Earth life chose L. This is the basis of what's the Lego principle. Life has to choose. Life can't just use all the organic molecules. It's not efficient. It chooses some and uses them to the exclusion of other similar molecules. Here, life uses L, doesn't use D. Slide 17 shows how we might turn this into a search strategy when we get a sample of dead stuff from Enceladus. Slide 17 shows a distribution, a theoretical distribution of molecules, where I plotted the number of molecules versus the type in some general characteristic of type. A non-biological distribution should be smooth, statistically smooth. All the different types should be there at some relative concentration depending on their chemistry. Biology would not show that kind of pattern. Biology would show discrete concentrations of molecules at very high levels only. So in the middle of this diagram, I'm showing this looks like a picket fence. Those might represent the L amino acids, and the spaces between them might represent the D amino acids. In a non-biological distribution, both the L and the D would be present at roughly the same amount. But in a biological distribution, the L amino acids are much, much more concentrated than the D amino acids. So a biological distribution looks peculiar compared to the smoothness of a non-biological distribution. And that, we think, is a general characteristic of life, is that it's going to choose molecules and use them and not others. So slide 18, the next slide, shows what we hope to find, say, on Enceladus. We might find that there's a certain set of molecules that are used, not a smooth distribution. And what's more interesting is that molecules are different than the molecules we use. That would be evidence of life, even though all the organisms we'd be studying might be dead. We don't need a live organism to find evidence of life. Interesting paradox. Due to the way life in English means many different things. It means an individual organism, it means the metabolic processes of that individual organism, and it means the collective phenomenon of many individual organisms, and it means the essence of that phenomenon, even separate from the organisms themselves. So in a sense, when we search for life, we're searching for a word that's very hard to define in the English language, much less to define biologically. But dead alien microbes would be evidence of life. And they could be evidence of life if we could show that they have a discrete pattern of molecules that they use, such similar to evidence of life on Earth. And it would be interesting if we could show that they were a different set of molecules. That would prove that it was the second genesis. So the exciting thing for me about Enceladus is the chance that we will find in the plume of Enceladus dead microorganisms and be able to examine those microorganisms to see if they represent a different kind of biochemistry from the biochemistry we have on Earth. So that's Enceladus. Let's now turn to Titan, where we have a equally exciting but very different possibilities for astrobiology. So Titan, slide 19, we see the image of Titan taken from Voyager, in fact, many years ago, showing Titan's organic haze. Titan is surrounded by an orange cloud of organic goo. Well, that's interesting because it makes us think about Titan and Earth and the early Earth and organics on the early Earth. And in fact, in many ways, Titan is very much like the Earth. Slide 20, next slide, shows a comparison of Titan and the Earth. Titan's gravity is less, it's about the same as the Moon, but its atmosphere is very similar. Titan is the only world in the solar system, of all the moons and planets, only Titan has an atmosphere that's within a factor of 10 of the pressure of Earth. It's also the only object in the solar system that, like Earth, has an atmosphere dominated by nitrogen. It's also a world which has a hydrological cycle. It has rivers and lakes and rain. But on Earth, rivers and lakes and rain are water. On Titan, the rivers, lakes, and rain are methane and ethane. Titan also has an interesting greenhouse effect, different from Earth, but interesting. The biggest difference between Earth and Titan is Titan is very cold. See, in this comparison, Titan is minus 180 degrees centigrade. Pretty chilly beanie compared to Earth, plus 15. And that generates probably from a biological point of view, the most important difference between Earth and Titan. Earth has liquid water, Titan does not. Water on Titan is essentially a rock. And I also show the rotation and solar orbit. The Titan has a liquid. Let's go to the next slide, which is the water cycle on Earth. What makes Earth such an interesting world? What makes Earth a world that can sustain such a diversity of life is the water cycle. Earth has water. Not just does it have water, but the water moves. Water is in cycles. This is a diagram from the U.S. Geological Survey showing the water cycle. And that is the essence of understanding life on Earth, is understanding the water cycle. Life on Earth is made of water, lives in water, and is widespread on the Earth because water is widespread on the Earth. Well, if we go to Titan, slide 22, what we have on Titan is a methane cycle. It has many of the same attributes as the water cycle on Earth, but it involves liquid methane. It has clouds and rain and rivers, but they're made of methane instead of water. Keep that in mind as we think about the possibilities for life on Titan. Well, let's go back to the organic stew on Titan. Slide 23 shows the known composition of Titan's atmosphere. These are things that have been measured in the atmosphere directly. You can see there's a whole host of organic molecules produced by photochemical reactions triggered in the methane and nitrogen. It's a prebiotic reactor. The next slide shows a laboratory simulation of a prebiotic reactor. If we take a jar, and we flow through the jar nitrogen and methane at the same ratio as occur in Titan's atmosphere, and put a spark through it, we find that after a few days, the jar turns brown and all sorts of gooey material is made. So this kind of non-biological chemistry, organic chemistry, is occurring on Titan, and it's occurring in these jars. And that's interesting from an astrobiology point of view in what it might tell us about how life started on Earth. Maybe we go back to the theories to the origin of life and the organic soup theory. Maybe this was the organic soup that was made on early Earth, and we're seeing the same sort of soup production going on Titan. But it certainly has a lot of interesting organics. And the next slide shows a sign that we ought to put up on Titan. This world contains compounds known to the state of California to cause cancer. We're required by law to put that up anywhere where California, where there's anything bizarre, chemistry or carcinogen. So Titan would certainly deserve such a sign. It's got a very interesting chemistry. But now let's see, is there a possibility that chemistry on Titan goes beyond just a model for the origin of Earth and goes to life itself? The next slide, slide 26, asks the question, does Titan mystery number 6? This comes from a list of Titan mysteries I put together. Mostly it has to do with the physics of Titan, but number 6 was the astrobiological one. Are there aliens? Could there be life on Titan? And the little diagram here, the little cartoon here, is not meant to be an accurate representation of alien life on Titan. It's just a pretty picture. But suppose, could there be aliens on Titan? Well, slide 27 puts this in context. Let's compare Earth and Titan and life on Earth and Titan. On Earth, life is carbon-based, living in liquid water. Because it's carbon-based and living in liquid water, life on Earth is widespread because water is widespread and carbon is widespread. There are lots of places on Earth where organisms can live because what they live in is all over the place, water. Well, on Titan, there's lots of carbon, as we've been talking about, and there's a liquid that's widespread. But that liquid is not water. That liquid is methane. So if there was life that could live in liquid methane instead of liquid water, carbon-based life living in liquid water, then it could be widespread on Titan. So Earth-like life that lives in water is not going to be doing very well on Titan. There's not very many places, if any, where there's liquid water on Titan. Maybe deep below the surface, but we're certainly not going to get to that anytime soon. The fact that there's a liquid on Titan's surface really is what's become the attraction for astrobiology. Could that liquid be a liquid that supports life? We're so used to thinking that water is the liquid for life, we haven't really given much thought to the possibility that other liquids might support life. Maybe liquid water could support, liquid methane could support life. Now, it'd be a very thin, very cold base for life, but life could adapt to that. Then the question is, could that life in liquid methane have an energy source? Slide 28 shows a calculation which illustrates that there could be life on Titan energetically. And this is a calculation of the energies of reaction that would be available to organisms on Titan if they consumed organics and consumed the organics with hydrogen. We know that there's hydrogen in Titan's atmosphere, and we know that there's organics on the surface and in the atmosphere. An organism that ate the organics and breathed the hydrogen would be able to generate energy. On Earth, we humans and other heterotrophs eat organics and breathe oxygen, and we react the oxygen with the organics. Well, on Titan, organisms could eat organics and breathe hydrogen and react the hydrogen with the organics, as shown in these reactions, essentially to produce methane. And the amount of energy released by these reactions are larger than the minimum energy that methanogens need on Earth. So there could be hydrogen-consuming life on Titan. And if it's there, it could consume the hydrogen. The life could be vigorous enough that it could deplete the hydrogen. And so the next slide, slide 29, is a calculation of the hydrogen concentration expected as a function of the biological consumption. So on the left of the slide is basically no biological consumption. And as the biological consumption gets bigger and bigger and bigger, there reaches a point where the biological consumption of hydrogen is strong enough that it depletes the hydrogen. That is similar to the way that life on Earth, plants on Earth in particular, can deplete CO2 in the atmosphere. A plot of CO2 over the year shows it going up in the winter and down in the spring as plants consume the CO2 in their growth. Well, the same thing would be true on Titan. And the next slide, slide 30, shows what you'd expect, what you'd predict that the Huygens probe would have detected if there had been vigorous hydrogen-consuming life on Titan. If there was no life, the probe should see the red line, hydrogen straight all the way down to the surface. But if there is life at the surface consuming the hydrogen, then as the probe got near the surface, there should have been a drop in the hydrogen concentration. Well, did the probe see that? The answer is we don't know. The probe, in principle, the probe could detect hydrogen, but the carrier gas that the probe used was hydrogen also. So it will take some more calibration to pull out the hydrogen signal. And the team that is doing the probe, GCMS, the mass spectrometer, hasn't yet done that calculation. But if we see a drop in hydrogen near the surface of Titan, the only explanation for it would be biology, which would be very interesting, because if we found biology on Titan living in liquid methane, we would know that it was a separate genus, because life on Earth is based in liquid water. If we found life based in liquid methane, we would know that it represents a completely different, independent type of life. And that would be very interesting, because it would suggest not only is life more widespread, but it's also more versatile, and it can use other liquids besides water, which is something that, again, we will never know from just studying the Earth, because on Earth, the only life that we know is based in liquid water. Next slide, slide 31 is the end. Last slide, the end of the talk. And so now what I was thinking is we could have time for questions if there are any.
Are there any questions? Well, Chris, I have a question. I know that there's a lot of work being done currently thinking about the next big, flagship mission that NASA is going to start funding. There's a lot of pre-planning work, and the big items that seem to have floated to the top in terms of the targets is Titan and the Europa mission, and both of those really do have this, this astrobiological question that is so interesting. If you had your preference, which one would you like to see?
Well, I don't know. That's a hard choice. I think Europa, Titan, and Enceladus are all good candidates for an astrobiology mission. I guess if I was running the show, I wouldn't pick one. What I would do instead was do smaller missions to all three. I wouldn't do a flagship mission where I put all my bucks into one mission, send it to one object. I would do smaller missions to all three, like I would do a Stardust flyby through Enceladus, pick up some of that stuff and bring it home, and do a impact sampling on Europa and maybe something else on Titan. But try with smaller missions to go for all three targets, because we don't know which of those three is really going to be the most interesting. And if we invest in a flagship mission, we're basically tying up our assets for the next decade. And if we pick right, that's great. But if we pick wrong, I wonder about dropping Enceladus off the list. There's a planet that's spitting out water. That's hard to pass up. I guess I didn't really answer your question, but I redefined your question.
What was a good answer? They're all interesting targets. I love your idea of the Stardust collector through the Enceladus plume. I don't know where I hadn't heard that yet, and I think that is a fantastically interesting thing to do.
Yeah, and that might be done for much less than a flagship mission cost. So, who knows? Hopefully, managers that are much wiser than us are working these problems.
So, does anyone else have a question?
Yes, I do. This is Bob Kaplow in Dundee, Illinois.
Go ahead.
Yes.
Can you tell the difference between looking back at the slide you said where if you find life like us, it's easy but less interesting?
Yep.
How would you distinguish finding life that's like us versus, oops, we accidentally had some contamination on the probe and we found our own life?
Yeah, that's a hard question, because if it's like us, it could be us, quite literally. It could have been for contamination. So we have to be very careful in sterilization and cleanliness. So the possibility of finding something we brought with us is always a concern.
Thank you.
I have a question, John Sheff from Cambridge, Mass. In terms of the Stardust type collection of possible organic material, would the space probe move through the plume maybe too rapidly to collect the particles and keep them intact enough for biological analysis back on Earth?
Well, that would be a design requirement. You want to slow it down enough so that it could, that the stuff that collected didn't get vaporized and destroyed, for sure. I don't know how slow that would have to be. It probably has to be less than a relative velocity of a couple kilometers per second. But the aerogel collector that was used on Stardust is very good at catching material without destroying it.
Thank you.
Question?
I have a question.
Go ahead.
Guys, this is Earl Kyle in Rochester, Minnesota. One of the Apollo missions brought back a television camera from the moon on a surveyor probe, and when they analyzed it, they found the organisms had survived. Can you comment on that story, and how was it that they were able to survive those many years up there in that harsh environment?
Yeah, that there is a report, a published paper, documenting that the surveyor camera brought back by Apollo 12, I think it was.
Yes, because they landed 200 feet away from the probe.
Exactly. Had bacteria on it, inside it.
Right.
And this is not surprising, really. LDEF, the Long Duration Exposure Facility, took bacteria up into Earth orbit for was supposed to be a few months, ended up being 6 years. And bacteria survived in that as well. And the explanation seems to be that, for example, on the moon, what would kill organisms would be direct exposure to the sun, ultraviolet light from the sun. But organisms shielded, for example, inside a camera, not being exposed to the ultraviolet light from the sun, would only experience two effects, vacuum and cosmic radiation. And neither of those would kill an organism very quickly. An organism shielded from sunlight could survive many years in space, maybe even thousands of years in space, before it was killed by gradual accumulation of radiation.
Okay, and then my second question was, what are your thoughts about the possibility of finding life beneath the surface of Mars? I think the Europeans are designing an exobiological rover that's supposed to probe 6 feet down. What are your thoughts about that possibility and success?
Yeah, I think that we may also, in addition to Enceladus and Europa, find evidence of past microbial life on Mars. That's a whole talk all by itself, but the answer is yes. I think there's a good chance that Mars will also, we will also face the same challenge of how do we tell that this gooey stuff was once alive, which is why on my slide I said, or Mars or Enceladus, or Europa, sorry, both those worlds, three worlds, Mars, Europa, and Enceladus, we have a possibility of finding organic material that may have been alive at one point.
Question?
This is Greg Cermak.
Yeah, this is Earl Hammond.
Okay, Earl, how about you first and then Greg?
Okay, I'm fascinated by your suggestion on a Stardust mission around Enceladus. I'm wondering what information could that type of a mission collect that Cassini doesn't collect now by flying through the plumes?
Well, Cassini was not designed as an organic analyzer mission. The most relevant instrument on Cassini is the mass spectrometer, the ion neutral mass spectrometer. But it only detects up to atomic mass of 200. It basically detects fragments and small molecules. What we'd like is to be able to bring the sample back to Earth and detect it with a much more sophisticated GCMS than is on Cassini. Look for more complex organics, and Cassini can look for.
Okay, thank you.
And Greg, your question?
Could you elaborate on any of the current techniques that would be used to survey any of these ecosystems that you're talking about, possibly in comparison to those that they used on Viking and also compared to isotropic fractionation, et cetera?
Well, I think what we would do, the instrument of choice right now would be a GCMS, very similar to the one that flew on Viking, maybe with a higher or a more sophisticated sample preparation mechanism. But the actual analytical instrument could be a GCMS. And it would, as you point out, have the capability to do isotopes. But that's a key, I didn't mention it in detail, but that's a key feature of molecules, again, that life tends to select is certain isotopes versus others. So it can be another part of this pattern that we're talking about in terms of a Lego pattern.
Question?
Go ahead.
This is Mike Hotka in Colorado. What time is that press conference tomorrow, and is it on NASA TV?
I don't know the details.
The press conference tomorrow is at 11 o'clock Pacific time, and it is on NASA TV. I believe the panel consists of Dr. Hunter Waite, who's the ion and neutral mass spectrometer PI that Dr. McKay just discussed. John Spencer, who's on the SIRS instrument, that's the composite infrared spectrometer, I think. I should know this. And finally, the final panelist is Dr. Larry Esposito, who is the PI for the UVIS instrument, the ultraviolet spectrometer.
That's good. Thanks.
And you can go, this is Jane in the Cassini Outreach. You can go to the Cassini website and get some information about that press conference. And it's also on the blog, our Enceladus blog. There's a nice feature about the press conference tomorrow.
Okay.
So, yeah, it'll be streaming on NASA.gov. It'll be, you know, you can get it lots of different places.
Okay, do we have any other questions?
Yes, question.
Go ahead.
John Smith, JPL. Getting back to the contamination issue, how can we tell if we find life on these bodies that is very similar to Earth, that it wasn't transported, say, from Earth due to an asteroid impact? I've read about transfer between the planets, theoretically.
Yeah, that's another possibility in the category of panspermia, if you will, which is that life started on Earth and then impact spread it around the rest of the solar system, or that life started on Mars and impact spread it around the rest of the solar system. And then what we'll find is not a second genesis on these worlds, but, you know, our distant cousins who moved in earlier.
Will we be able to tell that it did not start on Earth, or will it just be nebulous?
It'll be hard to reach a definitive conclusion. I think we'll need other information to... We'd have to work it further to try to understand where it started.
Thank you.
Okay, do we have any more questions? Okay, hearing none, I'd like to thank Dr. McKay for joining us today. It was really fantastically interesting, Chris, and we appreciate you taking your time putting together the presentation and spending an hour or so with us online today.
My pleasure.
And the next telecon will be the last Tuesday in April, which is March 29th, but I don't know what the topic is, so we'll have to wait for Amanda to send that out. I'm sure it will be interesting. She has been doing a fantastic job getting some great scientists to support the Charm Telecon. And with that, we'll sign off, and everyone have a nice month.